The nice thing about the way that God has directed the layout of the Bible is that, you know, after a judgment comes the encouragement. We saw that in Micah, didn't we? God saying, you know, I'm going to smack you down. I'm going to smite you. I'm going to squish you like a bug. But then I'm going to bring you back. You know, God always has a way of never letting you just kind of go into the pit and further and further, further, further down until you're just squashed. But he always makes sure to offer that word of encouragement. Well, Ruth is that word of encouragement after the book of Judges. And it says in chapter 1, verse 1, that it came about in the days when the judges governed. That is that same time period. It's the judges spanned from about 1400 B.C., to about 1000 BC. BC numbers are always hard because they work backwards. You know, if we're talking about a year, we go forward, but BC, it goes backwards. So it's 1400 to 1000. And so during the time of the judges, 1400 to 1000 BC, this happened, the events of the book of Ruth. What happened in the book of Ruth? Well, there was a famine in the land. No kidding. No kidding. You read Judges. And you also went with us in the earlier pages of the law as you've been doing this on Sunday nights. What's happened? God has given his law and he has pronounced blessings and curses. And part of the curses were, if you don't obey the voice of the Lord, then I'm not going to let it rain. If you don't obey the voice of the Lord, I'm going to turn your land into bronze and iron. It's going to be not producing any fruit. There's a famine in the land. No kidding. Because the people during the time of the judges were horribly sinful. And so now in the land of Israel, we see that there is a famine. Well, a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons. Now remember, there was two Bethlehems. We talked about this recently. Two Bethlehems, one of which is way up north. One of which is the Bethlehem that you're familiar with. You've sung songs, O little town of Bethlehem, the city, or I should say the town, where Christ was born. Now, what you may not know is that this sentence that we just read is the reason that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. It really is. This man, certain man from Bethlehem, the fact that he left resulted in Jesus being born in Bethlehem. Now, you have to know the whole story to see why, but he's going to leave only to have his family return in a different form. And because of that, the ancestors of King David, and David being the ancestor of Mary and Joseph, ended up in Bethlehem. So what we see is that this sentence was the cause of Jesus ultimately being born in Bethlehem. So this guy from Bethlehem, there's a famine in the land. He goes to the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. So they were called Ephrathites because the city of Bethlehem was Bethlehem Ephrathah, because it was founded by the guy named Ephrath, and so they're called Ephrathites. So, in case you wanted to know that. Now, they entered the land of Moab and remained there. Now, that might just sound like the setup to a story, but there's actually far more detail in here than you might expect. If you happen to be pregnant or praying about the name of a child, or maybe you have a child and you're considering changing his or her name, Mahlon and Chilion, bad choices. Mahlon means sick. Chilion means wasting away. These guys probably did not come out of the womb going, yeah, that's right, I'm bad. You know, it's like they were probably really in really bad shape. They were probably really sickly. They were probably not of strong constitution. You know, they had glasses with white tape in the middle. Nose spray. Pocket protectors. You get the idea. These are not healthy guys, and apparently neither was their dad. And so what we see is Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. So he obviously was not of strong constitution. And Naomi was left with her two sons. They took for themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of one was Orpah. That's not Oprah, by the way. That's Orpah. And the name of the other, Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. And the woman was bereft of her two children and her husband. This is getting to be kind of a sad story already. I mean, the famine came upon the land because there was sin in the land. Instead of trusting in God and saying, hey, maybe if we repent, God will end the pestilence and the famine. Instead, they went to the land of Moab, where they weren't supposed to be, married Moabites, which they weren't supposed to do, and then the guy dies, and then the two sons die. This is not a great story so far. And so she arose, this Naomi woman, with her daughters-in-law, that she might return from the land, that she might return from the land of Moab, for she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food. Translation, after 10 years, the Israelites finally repented, and so God relented. We talked about this in our study of Micah. If the people will repent, God will relent. If they will turn from their sin, God will bless them instead of cursing them. And so she departed from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. So they're headed back to Israel now. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. So she says, ladies, go back home. I have nothing to offer you. Number one, you're Moabites. And, you know, we don't really have any kind of solution. My husband sold the land that we owned. And according to the Jewish law, the only one who can marry me and redeem the land would be one of my husband's brothers. Well, there are none. And so I have even less hope than you do of being remarried. Now, in today's society, an independent, liberated woman might say, well, who needs a man? Right? That's the best I could do. We don't need no men, right? Well, in those days, they did. They really did. Because unlike now, you know, that a woman can go into the workplace and make a very good living for herself, it was not thus in the early Bible days, the Old Testament days, that a woman was dependent. As a widow, she'll be dependent on the welfare system. And if she wants any kind of life at all, she needs to be married. And so that's not a comment on women. It's just a comment on the society of the day. And so she sends them back home. Go home to your parents' households. Get married again. Live your life. All right, I've got nothing to offer you. And so she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said, no, we want to return with you to your people. Naomi said, return, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Naomi had to marry one of her husband's brothers, of which there were none. They would have to marry one of Naomi's sons, of which there were none. And so, you know, I don't have any. Return, my daughters. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I said I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown? You know, even if I had a husband tonight, even if I gave birth tonight, what are you guys going to wait around till for 20 years until they're old enough to marry? Would you therefore wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you. For the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me. And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Then she said, behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people. Now, a sentence that's missing from here that I think it would be really telling about this woman Orpah was, she said, Naomi said to the two girls, leave. Just go back home. And they both said, no. And Naomi said, really, you should leave. And Orpah went, okay, see ya. She's gone. She's out of there. But Ruth isn't doing that. Orpah's gone. She's left. But Ruth is still clinging to her. And she says, behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. You see, the Moabites had not turned to the Lord. These two women had not turned to the Lord when they married these guys. The man, Elimelech, he had not directed his family in a godly way that had said, look, it's a sin to be married to an unbeliever. And so, as it went, they still had their gods, but Ruth, not anymore. She says, don't urge me to leave you or turn back from following you, but where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. And so that was her commitment. I'll go back to the land of Israel. I'll become a Jew. I want to be with you. I recognize your God as the real God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me. Boy, you know the proverb that says there is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. This seems to be it. When Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. So they both went until they came to Bethlehem. And when they had come to Bethlehem, all the city was stirred because of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? 10 years in rebellion. 10 years in the land of Moab. 10 years had passed. This was not one of these, oh, you know, you've really aged well. Is this Naomi? Have you ever met someone that used to walk with the Lord and then walked away from the Lord and you hadn't seen them in a while? Have you noticed how sin affects the countenance? Have you noticed how sin will devastate a person? There are people that you meet. You can meet a woman and be convinced that she can't be over 40 years old, and turns out she's in her late 50s or mid-60s. Then you can meet someone who you swear is in their 60s or 70s, and they're only in their 40s. Sin is hard on a person, and rebellion against God will change your countenance. Very often, you can just see. You can see with the laugh lines or the frown lines who has been walking with the Lord in a victorious, happy walk and who is not. Time eventually tells. And as we covered that in Matthew about wisdom being vindicated by all her children, time will tell. Time will tell how the person's walk is. They come back and they say, is this Naomi? Well, they didn't have to look at her face to find out where she's at with the Lord. She said to them, don't call me Naomi. See, Naomi means sweetness. Instead, call me Mara. Mara means bitter. Don't call me sweetness. Call me Mara. Call me bitter. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, which is a lie, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Well, it wasn't the Lord who ultimately caused her to go down this path. Why do you call me sweetness? Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? So you can tell this woman has some issues, you know. So Naomi returned, and with her Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain, after one in whose sight I may find favor. And she said, go, my daughter. So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. Now, we talked a little bit this morning about God's law of provision and welfare, of when the Pharisees were rebuking Jesus for allowing his disciples to pick the heads of grain on the Sabbath as they were walking through the grain fields. We talked about how this was specified in the law, that it was okay. Well, not only that, and I made the joke about, you know, you're not allowed to bring a basket, and it actually says, you know, you can't take a sickle to your neighbor's grain. And yet, after they take the sickle to the grain, it was the welfare system that God designed that they were not to go back. As a matter of fact, let's read this. That's in Leviticus chapter 19. That God has, you know, God's a great manager. He's thought of everything. And, you know, it's probably because he knows everything and that makes him a good manager. But in Leviticus 19, verse 9, he says, When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you glean the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God. This was God's welfare system. When you harvest, you go through once. You don't go through again and pick up everything that you missed and then go through again and make sure that you get every last little thing. You go through once. Whatever's left, you allow the poor people, the widows, the needy, the orphans to go through, and that's going to be their only source of food since they don't have land on which to farm. Ruth and Naomi have nothing. They literally have nothing. And yet they say, or God's law says that they can go in and glean. And so that's what Ruth says to Naomi. Hey, can let me go glean. Let me go earn my keep here. Let me go bring back some food. And so she did. She happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now, and you can see the hand of God guiding this, because she didn't know where she was going. She was just going out to the fields. Well, she just happened to, quote unquote, end up in the field of Boaz. Now, behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, hey, may the Lord be with you. And they said to him, may the Lord bless you. Now, apparently this was a good guy to work for. This seems to be a godly man. It seems that his employees like him and he likes his employees, and their focus is on the Lord. A far cry from the way the land of Israel was 10 years prior when the famine was going on. Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? The servant in charge of the reapers replied, oh, she's the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. And she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. Thus she came and has remained from the morning until now. She's been sitting in the house for a little while. So he's saying, you know, she is working hard. She got here first thing this morning. She's been working and working and working. She's taking a break, but I mean, she's got a good work ethic here. And so Boaz said to Ruth, hey, listen carefully, my daughter. When the reason he's saying my daughter is he knows that he's related to Naomi. He's a relative, a very close relative of her deceased husband. And so knowing that this is Naomi's daughter-in-law, he's saying, hey, listen closely, my daughter. Don't go to glean in another field. Furthermore, don't go on from this one, but stay here with my maids. So he's offering protection here. He's saying, don't go anywhere else. Glean in this field. Glean in my field. Please let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. So my guys, as they're moving along, just follow them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw. And so he's really blessing her here. He could have just as easily said, yeah, whatever. I mean, the law of God says she has to, or I have to let her do this, but, you know, don't be nice to her or anything. Well, he's offering protection and provision. He's saying, hey, this is safety right here. Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner? Boaz replied to her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother and the land of your birth, and you came to a people that you did not previously know. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. Then she said, I have found favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and indeed have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants. At mealtime, Boaz said to her, hey, come that you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. So she sat beside the reapers, and he served her roasted grain, and she ate and was satisfied and had some left. So he's really continuing to provide for her and bless her. Well, now she rises to glean. Boaz commands a servant, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves. don't insult her. So he's saying, you know, even the stuff that you're harvesting, let her take some of that too. And also purposely pull out for her some grain from the bundles and leave it that she may glean, and don't rebuke her. And so he's saying, don't just let her take what falls, but make some extra fall there. You know, drop some of the good stuff so that she'll have enough. So she gleaned in the field until evening, and then she beat out what she had gleaned, and there was about an ephah of barley. Now, an ephah in grain measurement is about, if you picture, 6 1-gallon jugs. So she's got like, you know, a gallon of milk. You can picture that. 6 of these. She's after harvesting all this or gleaning all this and beating it out, she's got 6 1-gallon jugs of barley, which is, I mean, and they're only feeding her and Naomi. So it's more than enough. She took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She took it out and gave Naomi what she had left after she was satisfied. So Naomi ate 6 of the jugs and gave her... No, I'm just kidding. Naomi was a large woman. She had to be amazed in looking at this and going, you know, you don't get this from gleaning. This, you know, gleaning was just enough to get by, and pretty much each person had to glean for himself, because that was, you know, it would take you all day just to get enough food for one person for one day. She comes back with an ephah, 6 gallons of this stuff. And her mother-in-law said to her, where did you glean today and where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed. So it was obvious in the amount that she was noticed. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, well, the name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, he has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead. That's a fancy way of saying he hasn't forgotten me or my husband, his relative. Again, Naomi said to her, this man is our relative. He's one of our closest relatives. Then Ruth the Moabitess said, well, furthermore, he said to me, you should stay close to my servants until they have finished all my harvest. Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his maid so that the others do not fall upon you in another field. And so gleaning, you can see, was a dangerous thing, because although Boaz is a godly guy, not all the harvesters are, and it's possible they could take advantage of the situation and commit a criminal act. So she stayed close by the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. Then, in chapter 3, then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you? Now, is not Boaz our kinsman with whose maids you were? Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight. Is she saying, I'm obligated to you. You're my daughter-in-law. I'm obligated to you to find a husband from among our relatives. Well, Boaz, He's a kinsman. He's a very close relative. Now, if you turn back to Leviticus 25 for a minute, you see the necessity of the near kinsman. Leviticus 25, verse 23, that it was all about relatives. It was all about, I guess I should back up a little bit, especially if you haven't been with us through Deuteronomy and Joshua and talking about the division of the land. You see, God had the land divided up by inheritance. All the land belonged to God. He gave a huge portion of it to Israel and told them to divide that up by tribe. As they divided it up by the 12 tribes of Israel, they divided those tribes lands up by the different clans in the tribe, and then even smaller into the different families. And so everybody had their inheritance from the Lord, and that was supposed to be a perpetual inheritance. And so it's all about family. The marrying, it's got to stay in the family. If you happen to sell your land, it couldn't be sold for more than 50 years. It would revert in the year of Jubilee back to the original owners, to the original family, or it could be redeemed. But if it was going to be redeemed, you had to either buy it back yourself, or if you died it had to be the term in Hebrew is ga'al, which means kinsman. It's a kinsman redeemer. And so what we see in Leviticus 25 is in verse 23, the land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, God says. For you are but aliens and sojourners with me. Thus, for every piece of your property, you are to provide for the redemption of the land. If a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor that he has to sell part of his property, then his nearest kinsman, the Ga'al, is to come and buy back what his relative has sold. Or, in case a man has no kinsman, but so recovers his means as to find sufficient for his redemption, then he shall calculate the years since its sale and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it, and so return to his property. So basically, if he said, I'll sell you my land for $50,000, knowing that it would only be for 50 years, you calculated it out, it's $1,000 a year. If after 20 years you said, hey, I want to buy my land back, you owe the guy $30,000 because he paid you, you got the money for the first 20 years, the first $20,000, but the next 30 years, you pay him back. And so it was to be calculated that way. But if he has not found sufficient means to get it back for himself, then what he has sold shall remain in the hand of its purchaser until the year of Jubilee. At the year of Jubilee, it shall revert that he may return to his property. And so it's all the redemption of the land. It's tied into the relatives in the same way that the marrying thing had to be the relative. If your husband died, you had to marry his brother and then have kids in the name of the dead brother so that the inheritance all stayed the same. And so she's saying, hey, I need to find you a husband, and I need my land to be redeemed. Isn't Boaz our kinsman? So he's at the threshing floor. It's the end of the harvest. Now it's threshing time. This is the big celebratory part of year around the Feast of Tabernacles, I believe it was. And it was a very joyous time. It was a time of rejoicing because really, I mean, they're getting the whole harvest for the year. This is all the barley they're going to harvest for the year. This is a big, big to-do. And so she says, wash yourself and anoint yourself and put on your best clothes and go down to the threshing floor. But don't make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. It shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he will tell you what you shall do. Now, this sounds like some very strange instructions. And yet, for the godly man who knew the law of God, he would understand what's going on. He wouldn't think that this woman is coming on to him or anything. He would understand what was happening. So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Now, some people read this and go, oh man, he was toasted. He was drunk as a skunk. You know, he just collapsed right there in the threshing floor. Remember that this is the year's barley, and the owner of the field would always sleep on the threshing floor. It's like if you had a job where your boss paid you your whole year's wages all at once in cash, and the bank didn't open for a couple of days, you know, he paid you on Friday in cash, where are you going to put that? You're just going to, oh, throw it on the kitchen table, we'll go to church, come back. No, you're going to guard this. You're going to guard this because it's your whole year's wages. Well, and so that's what Boaz is doing. That's what any of the field owners would do, is sleep at the threshing floor. And so he's lying there. Well, she comes secretly, uncovers his feet, and lays down. It happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward. Behold, a woman was laying at his feet. He said, who are you? And she answered, I'm Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative. Again, this is not some seductress trying to come on to a guy. She is actually, and I wish this had been translated more accurately, when she says, spread your covering over your maid, she literally says, spread your wings over your maid. It's the same word that back in chapter 2, in verse 12, when he had said, may the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. That was a very common description of the wings of authority and protection. They often referred to being hidden under God's wings to find refuge under them, in the same way that a bird or a mother hen will gather her chicks under her wings to protect them. They described God in this way. They described any sort of covering of protection in this. So really what she says is, she's not saying, I want to share the place you're sleeping, you know, give me some blanket kind of thing. She's saying, I've come to you to seek refuge. You're my near kinsman. He understands what she's asking. She's asking, you are my Ga'al, my kinsman who can redeem me. You're a close relative that can marry me and continue our family name and the family inheritance. And so he said, may you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. Translation, I'm flattered. I'm old enough to be your dad. Boaz is not a, this is not, you know, basically, if you ever see this in cartoon or represented in the Sunday school stories, you know, it's always a nice couple in their late 20s, early 30s. Well, in reality, she's a young woman and he's an old guy that can't believe this young woman wants to marry him. You know, I heard how nice you were to your mother-in-law, Naomi. I mean, how you blessed her. But I got to tell you, it's a way bigger blessing, the fact that you're even considering marrying me, is what he's saying. So now, my daughter, do not fear. He's still calling her my daughter, which would kind of get old if you got married. Do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask. For all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. Now, it is true that I am a close relative. However, bum, bum, bum. There is a relative closer than I. Bum, 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 bum. Cut to commercial. Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you, good, let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning. So she lay at his feet until morning and rose before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. So this is a guy who doesn't just walk with the Lord, but he walks above reproach in a way that is not open to accusation. And so he said, give me the cloak that is on you and hold it. So she held it, and he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her. And then she went into the city. This was how much barley that she had collected. She had collected an entire ephah after a day's worth of work. Now he's measured out 6 measures to her. She doesn't even have to work today. Don't go to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Then she said, I'm sorry, I backed up a little bit, or I went forward a little bit. When she came to her mother-in-law, verse 16, she said, how did it go, my daughter? And she said, I wish everyone would quit calling me my daughter. No, she told her all that the man had done for her. She said, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said, do not go to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Now, this is the signal. Then she said, wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest until he has settled it today. How did she know that? Is she just guessing? No, she's saying this with certainty. You know, this was a signal. These 6 measures of barley are a signal. And people who are biblically educated and knowledgeable about the Hebrew culture would recognize a couple of things about this. Number one, measuring out 6 measures of meal draws to the remembrance when Abraham initiated the fellowship offering, which is 3 measures of meal. Remember when Genesis 18. Let's go over there for a minute. Genesis 18. The Lord appears to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre, And this is, if you're familiar with, this is when the Lord and two angels come and they stop by Abraham's house before the angels go into Sodom and rescue Lot and his wife, and the Lord rains down judgment and hail and fire and all this brimstone stuff. Well, he stop off at Abraham's house, or at his tent. And he says, come stay for lunch, you know, and produces what is the fellowship offering that he goes into his wife in verse 6. Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, quickly, prepare 3 measures of fine flour, knead it, and make bread cakes. 3 measures of meal became known as the fellowship offering. When you were offering fellowship and kinship and closeness with someone, you measured out 3 measures of meal. Now, we'll see this in a few weeks, maybe a couple weeks, in our studies of Matthew. You can read ahead in Matthew and figure out where I'm talking about. I'm already getting off track. 3 measures of meal is the fellowship offering. Boaz measured out to Ruth 6. What's he indicating? Not just the fellowship offering being given to Ruth, but also to Naomi. Naomi realizes he is extending his hand not only to you, but also to me, that he fully intends to redeem not only you and your hand in marriage, but also the land. And also, if you just think about it from a Genesis perspective again, then we talked about this morning too, about how God created the earth in 6 days and then he rested. Boaz measured out 6 measures of meal. What does that tell Naomi? The man will not rest until he has settled it today. And so 2 very clear signals to someone with the Jewish mindset. And so he is dealing with it today. Boaz goes up to the gate. We're back in Ruth chapter 4. Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by. So this is the guy. This is the closer relative than he. So he said, hey, turn aside, friend. Sit down here. He turned aside and sat down. He took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. Now, does that feel like a setup? Hey, buddy, come here, sit down. Hang on a second. 10 elders, come here. It's an intervention. We want to talk to you about your drinking. He took the 10 men of the elders of the city, said, sit down here. They sat down. Then he said to the closest relative, Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. So I thought to inform you, saying, well, buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if not, tell me that I may know. For there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you. And he said, I will redeem it. We don't want him to redeem it. We want Boaz to be the guy, right? I'm not that personally invested in this, but I know that some people read love stories and they really get emotionally involved, and I'm just trying to help you out. So here's the deal here it is. Here's the opportunity. The nearest kinsman has to have the first chance of redeeming. He's like, sure, I'll redeem it. No problem. Boy said, oh, by the way, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. So he's saying, oh, by the way, it's not just buying the land back. It's you also got to get married to this Moabite woman. The closest relative said, no, I cannot redeem it for myself because I would jeopardize my own inheritance. I don't know how this would jeopardize his inheritance unless he thought that if he and Ruth had children, then he would have to divide his inheritance between the sons. I'm not sure exactly how it would affect it. It's possible that even because she's a Moabite woman, that he had an issue with that affecting his inheritance. I don't know. But he tells Boaz, redeem it for yourself. You may have my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it. Now, this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning the redemption and exchange to confirm any matter. A man removed his sandal and gave it to another, and this was the matter of attestation in Israel. So the closest relative said to him, buy it for yourself, and he removed his sandal. There's some stuff missing here. in God's law, back in Deuteronomy 25, maybe turn there again. You know, we've got some time. I think we have some time. Yeah, okay. Deuteronomy chapter 25 talks about this very law. Now, you notice that in the book of Ruth, it had said this was the custom. You know, what was the law? What was the real deal here? Deuteronomy 25, around verse 5. And this kind of ties in everything we've been talking about in the book of Ruth. When brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man, or even a normal man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. Translation, you got to marry your brother-in-law and have kids with him. It shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. So that's the way they would do it, even though it's really the dead guy is the guy's uncle. They name him the same name so that genealogically it all just works out. That probably was more confusing than helpful. But if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, so he doesn't want to redeem her, he doesn't want to marry her, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, "My husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me." So it seems like the woman has to initiate this whole thing, and she has to deal with it legally if he refuses. Then the elders of the city shall summon him and speak to him, and if he persists and says, "I don't desire to take her," then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders, pull his sandal off his foot, and spit in his face. And she shall declare, "Thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. In Israel, his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal is removed." That's not what I would call him. Hey, I'm not even going to say nothing. I would just call him something else. So traditionally, they had kind of gone away from the law, and traditionally, they got rid of the spit part. They kept the shoe part and said, "You know, I don't want to redeem it. Here you go." That's kind of how they had narrowed that down. And so the house of him who had his sandal removed, the closest relative said, "Buy it yourself." He removed his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elder and all the people, "You are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to to the two sons. Moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance so that the name of the deceased will not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You are witnesses today." All the people who were in the court and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. And may you achieve wealth in Ephrathah and become famous in Bethlehem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, through the offspring which the Lord will give you by this young woman." So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today, and may his name become famous in Israel. May he also be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, especially the kind of sons you make, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. The neighbor women gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They put him in a circular bed and called him Obed. Oh. Don't you think a circular crib would be a cool thing? There was no corners to get stuck in. You could really mess him up, though, when he becomes a toddler. You say, go sit in the corner. Anyway, so they named him Obed. And you know why I do this, right? I do this so that you'll remember when you go back. And by the way, let's finish this and then we'll go somewhere else here. So they named him Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. David's grandpa, Obed. Okay? Now these are the generations of Perez. To be Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron was born Ram, and to Ram Amminadab, and to Amminadab was born Nahshon, and to Nahshon Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse David. Does that sound a little bit like when we started the Gospel of Matthew? Go to Matthew chapter 1. Talking about the record of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Talking about Jesus and his genealogy being from the tribe of Judah. In verse 3, Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez was the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Amminadab. Amminadab the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon the father of Salmon. Salmon was the father of Boaz by Rahab. Boaz was the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse. Jesse was the father of David the king. What did we just see here? We saw the parallel in the genealogy of this. It's kind of hard to describe the dynamics of the book of Ruth, because if Elimelech had not left Bethlehem and sold off his land, then they wouldn't have left. He and Naomi would have been married, and those two sickly guys would have married Israelite women. Boaz never would have been in the scene. Obed would have never been born, and then you wouldn't have had Jesse or David. You wouldn't have even had David. And ultimately, going down the line to Joseph and Mary, both descendants of David, in Matthew's case, as he's dealing with the legal ramifications of being the descendant of David, traces down to the line of Joseph. And Joseph was the engaged husband to Mary, the virgin who was pregnant, who's like 9.9 months pregnant at this point, and they get the alert from the government saying, you have to go to your hometown to be registered. Where was their hometown? The city of David, which was Bethlehem, which is why they went back to Bethlehem, where the Virgin Mary goes into labor and she gives birth to Jesus, thus fulfilling the prophecy of the Messiah being born in Bethlehem. God, like, has all this stuff juggling around. There's one thing that I often think about, and that's when someday when we're in the middle of eternity in heaven, you know, I think of all the cool stuff. I think of just worshiping the Lord, and I think about just sitting there listening to the word of the Lord going forth and asking questions, and I think about just fellowshipping with the Lord. There's one thing I've thought of that I do not want to do with the Lord, and that's play a game of chess. Because I will never win. He's got it all worked out. He's got all the different combinations and everything. It's like, it would be silly. It's like, you know, when I go to your kids in the Sunday school and I say, you want to play tic-tac-toe? They only do that like twice before they say, I don't like playing tic-tac-toe with Pastor Ronnie. He always wins, you know. It would be silly to try and play chess with God. And yet, if you think about it, he's got all this stuff worked out. He knows where he's been and where he's going. He knows all the different details. And what this, it just encourages me, because in my life, I often feel like I took a wrong turn and I ended up in a dead end and I have nowhere to go. God always makes a way. He always makes a way. If you think about it, Naomi is married to this sickly guy with two sickly men as sons. Elimelech says, we're selling the land and going to the land of the Moabites. Great. He dies. The sons die. I'm stuck with two idol-worshipping Moabite women as daughters-in-law.
Just don't call me sweetness anymore. Call me bitter. Look, I'm going to be on welfare. Even going back, I'm going to be on welfare. I'm too old to get married. I have no chance of getting the land back. Life is just horrible. And yet, God always makes a way. God always makes a way. Even all the way down the generations. I know that Mary was a godly woman. I don't know that Joseph was anything but righteous, because the Bible does say that he was a righteous man. Mary's godly, Joseph's righteous. But when they got the notice that the Roman government said, you have to go to the land of your birth, to your hometown, a trip to Bethlehem, that's great. With Christmas coming too. And what a horrible event. And of course, everybody goes faster than they do, which is, I believe, one of the big reasons why there was no room at the inn. Everybody, I mean, she's pregnant. Everybody's just kind of on the donkeys. She's not doing that. I mean, at least I'm assuming she wasn't doing that, being 8.9 months pregnant, you know. They get there, there's no room at the inn. What a horrible thing. What a terrible event. How many letters have you got in the mail that you went, this is it? How many phone calls have you got where you went, well, that's it. Now I'm at a dead end. I've got no hope. Nothing's going to work out. How many times have you got to the point of just, you know what, just call me bitter, okay? Just call me bitter because my life is horrible. God will make a way. He will make a way. He will work it out. And that's where, and you know, it just seems so simple to remind Christians who know the Bible, and yet, and never fails to minister to me, to think of Romans 8:28. We know that God causes all things to work together for good, for those that love God, for those who are called according to His purpose. And verse 29, for whom He foreknew, He also predestined to become conformed to the image of His Son, these people, that He might be the firstborn among many brethren. What is God saying? God is saying, I foreknew you. I called you to be my son or my daughter. I've called you to be a child of God. You can trust me. I'm working it out for good. You may be 8.5 months pregnant and having to be on the road. I'm working it out for good. Your husband and 2 sons may die in a foreign land, and God's working it out. You may even be at the point of just total bitterness and saying, just call me bitter, because that's what I am. And God's working it out. He really is. God will make a way. Let's pray.